The Virginia Voice presents What's Your Story? Our program is based on the idea that everybody has a story to tell. All you have to do is ask. Now, here's the host of What's Your Story, Don Dale.
Hello, and welcome once again to What's Your Story? My guest this time is Bobby Barajas, the music director for WCVE Public Radio and the host of the classical music program that airs from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Monday through Friday. And Bobby, we start our program with a question that almost always prompts a conversation. What's your earliest childhood memory?
I remember very clearly playing in my grandmother's house and being small enough to where, I guess I remember being carried, you know, being put down on the floor, being put up on the couch, and just playing at her house. And I remember that we played a little game with a button, and we put it in our hands, and that say, button, who's got the button, and you pass it around. And I guess I was big enough, you know, to be able to play that game with the big people, with the adults. I thought I was something else.
How old were you? Do you have any?
I'm thinking maybe 3, 4. I know I wasn't in school yet.
Where was this?
Harlingen, Texas.
Now, where is Harlingen in Texas?
If you go way, way down to the most southern tip of the state, Harlingen, Texas is maybe 45 minutes from the U.S.-Mexico border in Brownsville, Texas. So very, very far away from Richmond, Virginia.
And did you grow up there?
I did. I grew up. I was born and raised in Harlingen, and that's still home. The family is all still down there. I'm the one who went away.
And a big family?
You know, my immediate family, I have two younger brothers, and one of my brothers is married, and I now have a little niece who is the center of my life. But yeah, an extended family, yes. Lots of cousins, aunts, uncles.
And you went to school there?
I did. I went to school, you know, elementary, middle, high school. I went to University of Texas at Brownsville, Texas Southmost College. And then when it came time to go away, I went to school in Atlanta and Dallas at the Art Institutes, which is one of the few places you can actually learn audio engineering.
I assume, correct me if I'm wrong, that when you were in high school, you began to get an idea of what you wanted to do with your life.
Yes, I did. I was very interested in the whole idea of mixing boards and that kind of thing. And I liked the idea of playing with sound. And my early years in college, there was actually a course being offered at the college for audio engineering. And I decided I really did like that and I wanted to pursue it. And happening at the same time, I got my first job in radio. So I was kind of playing with this equipment all the time anyway, and I thought this kind of seems to be a path that is choosing me.
What sparked that interest?
You know, I think, honestly, it was probably just some kid's fascination with music. But the idea of what does recording engineer mean? What does sound engineer mean? What do these things mean? But I think it was my first job in radio that to me really said, you need to follow this because you have practical application of these skills when you're in the station, when you're in the radio booth, when you're in production.
I thought you were going to tell me that your earliest love was classical music. I'm assuming now that the classical music followed the interest in radio?
Well, starting in elementary school, all the way through high school and college, I was in choir. And I have made contact, reestablished contact with all of my old choir directors to say thank you for teaching me how to pronounce all these crazy things, because never did I think that one day I would use this on air.
What was the format of that first radio station?
It was what they called middle of the road, which was unusual because they would actually start the hour with Frank Sinatra and end it with Billy Joel. It was kind of everything in there, but maybe softer Billy Joel.
And then you did progress into classical music? What was that, something that happened because of your doing or just because of what was available?
Yes, I followed a professor I called him my unofficial counselor. After I finished everything that the college had to offer, he said, okay, you need to go and study at this other place. I followed everything he asked me to do, and when I came back after graduation, he said, you are now ready to go to this station. It was the first public radio station ever, in Harlingen, Texas, in that entire region. And he said, you're now qualified to go and be their program director. And I didn't realize it at the time, but when I was in college, I was helping with all kinds of things that would start this brand new station that I ended up signing on the air for the very first time.
What year was that?
That was 1991, April of 1991.
So in 1991, you get a job at a station in Texas.
I did, and it was the very first public radio station that had ever been in that area, and I was the program director, and they gave me a box of CDs and a book, which was the National Public Radio Program Offering Book. It was called Quarterly Edition. And they said, go figure out what we're going to do. I was like, well, okay. I think I know this.
Is it 24 hours you had to fill?
You know, at the time we were off air from midnight till 6 in the morning. That's still a lot of programming. And literally all I had was one box of CDs. So that wasn't a whole lot. So I thought we're going to depend on NPR for a lot of things. I mean, I didn't even know what Car Talk was, because that area where I had grown up, we'd never had public radio. So it was a true education in public radio. Thank goodness I knew. I felt more comfortable with the music than I did with the idea of figuring out what all of these things were. And the internet was around, but not the way it is now. Like, You couldn't even really go and look things up. It was something else, but we did it. We signed on, and the very first piece I played on air was Aaron Copland's Fanfare for the Common Man. A lot of thought went into what it should be significant what we play, that first piece.
Right.
And I really felt that I wanted it to be a station for everybody, not just people that had some big music education or, you know, any kind of elitist attitude. It really didn't need to be for the common man, because it would be the common man that would support it. So it was a grand adventure, and I will just never forget those days.
And it was a good piece.
It's
very uplifting and very affirming.
Yes, and it's, I don't know, I guess I've kind of adopted it as being something really special for me. It marked a very special day and time in my life.
Did you enjoy your time there?
I did.
This was your first hands-on experience with actually a professional job in radio.
Well, no, I started professionally in radio when I was 18. So at this point, I was 21, still very young. But it was the first time that I had a boss who was the station CEO, but I was in charge of everything in radio. I had to hire people. Even something as simple as write the legal ID. I had to format the station. I had to decide everything that was going to be on it. I had to train the people that would be on air. I always felt like it was my baby.
Did you take the classical musical slot?
Yes, I did.
What time of day?
It seems like I've always been on in the middle of the day for as long as I can remember. So I guess it was 11 till 2 or 3 in the afternoon.
And was it like we are used to in public radio in Richmond, where it's a mix of a lot of different kinds of programming throughout the day? Talk, music, and...
It was a whole lot like we have right here at WCVE, Morning Edition, Performance Today, then Classical in the Afternoon. Actually, it's exactly as we have it, but although all things considered, we didn't start it until 5 in the afternoon. Here we started at 4, but it was pretty much that same format. We did have daily jazz, although it was earlier in the day than we have it here.
Is that sort of the way it works at most public radio stations?
For the most part, there are stations that just do completely different things and don't even air classical or jazz. They air folk music or, you know, any number of things. There's a lot of material out there. My education in public radio was getting on the phone and talking to people. So I modeled a lot of what we did off of just cold calls that I made to other public stations to get an idea, because I thought, I don't know what this is supposed to be. I was educating myself as I was then going to turn and go on the mic and attempt to educate an audience in what it meant to have public radio and how the station and the public would work together to keep that station afloat.
How long did you stay there?
I was there until the end of November 1997.
And then you went to?
Pittsburgh, Kansas. Another little town.
But no H on the end of Pittsburgh.
No H at the end of that, yes. And I was at KRPS in Pittsburgh, Kansas, and we actually served Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Missouri. That was some weather forecast you'd have to do, let me tell you.
I can imagine.
Because you could have four completely different weather systems happening at that time. And that is actually where I met Peter Solomon. who is our jazz host here at WCVE Public Radio.
You two worked together there.
We worked together there. Yes, we did. And, you know, became friends. And I think I can say that for myself working at KRPS, it was a great education that I received there, not only learning from other people, but taking something that is called International Phonetic Alphabet,
right,
which helps people to, singers. Singers are the people who use this. Mm-hmm. And I've been a singer, all my life, but in school, in elementary, junior, and high school.
Where the teacher would say, you pronounce it this way.
Exactly. Vocal students, there's not necessarily somebody's going to tell you how to pronounce something. You better be able to figure it out, no matter what the language. So we decided that it would be beneficial for me to take that, not as a singer, but as a person that would have to say these things on air. The names.
From every language imaginable.
Yes.
And the International Phonetic Alphabet, it's not A, B, C, D, E, F, G.
No.
It's strange little forms,
yes,
upside down E's and backward C's, and each
exactly
one of them has a precise sound.
Yes.
And so when you string them together, in theory, you can pronounce anything.
Yes. Yes.
So that's how you learn.
That's how I learned to say things that just didn't naturally come to mind for me.
Mm-hmm.
Italian, French, Spanish, the Romance languages, I could do those.
Right.
But yeah, German wasn't as natural to me,
mm-hmm,
as were those other languages. So yeah, so IPA, International Phonetic Alphabet.
Peter Solomon, we should mention, is the jazz host here at WCVE from 7 to 10 each,
mm-hmm,
evening. And you're classical, he's jazz. What do you two talk about?
Pete is the neatest guy. He'll come in here every afternoon. We end up having a little chat for a few minutes, and he'll always have some great story that he's working on. You would think that we would talk about classical or jazz, but Pete's just always got, some great feature story that he's working on, actually many times about Richmond, sort of the forgotten histories of,
mm-hmm,
Richmond. But, at this point, we share a lot of history. We talk about his niece, who is now a teenager. I think, my goodness, when I first met Pete, I remember when she was born.
Mm.
So, and now he's learning about my,
That happens, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And Pete and one of my brothers actually went to North Texas University. And they have a lot of the same friends, and they ran in the same circles. So, now I think I was supposed to meet Pete. That's just part of the life plan.
Part karma.
Yes. Yes, I believe so.
And Pete led to your coming to Richmond in a way.
Yes. The person who had my job previously had decided that they were going to move on. And so Pete called and said, this job has just become available. You're perfect for it. You have to apply. And I was really hesitant because being in Kansas, I was one state over from Texas. It was relatively easy to get home. But to come all the way to the East Coast in Virginia just seemed like, oh my gosh, that's really far away.
And you'd been in two flat places.
Yes, yes.
And now all of a sudden there are hills and
hills,
even mountains and a seashore.
Exactly. I grew up on the Gulf, so I was good with the ocean. I could handle that.
Okay.
But the mountains, that was a whole other matter. I came to Richmond for the interview, and I remember going to Maymont. It was the craziest thing. Pete was to pick me up to bring me to the station for the interview. And he said, but first you have to see Maymont. Okay. Well, I didn't realize. Here I am dressed for an interview, and he wants me to walk all over this park. I was into it a little bit. I said, Pete, I'm going to be all gross and sweaty for the interview. I'm sorry. We can do this later. But he was so excited about the city.
Get you excited?
He did. He really did. He took me to Cuba Cuba. That was the first restaurant I ever went to in Richmond, and it's stayed a favorite. But I remember thinking Maymont was just an amazing place. We went over the Huguenot Bridge, and when I drove over that, I remember thinking, I could live here. Mm-hmm. I didn't know it was kind of a shaky bridge, but it is a beautiful view. So I think that the river actually played a big part of me falling in love with the city as a whole.
How is the audience here different from the audiences in Kansas and Texas? Or is there a difference?
I think there is a difference because where I come from, Harlingen, Texas is 9 hours away from Dallas, Texas, from Fort Worth.
Nine hours. In the same state.
In the same state, yeah.
Wow.
And when I was a kid, they eventually formed a local symphony, But the symphony that I got to hear was when the Fort Worth Symphony would come to town. And it was a big, big deal. And so you really appreciated, or I mean, at least I did, when I would get to see them that once a year. And I know that there are generations of us in that part of Texas that grew up with that same appreciation. However, there was not the understanding that this is something that can happen pretty frequently, not just once a year. Here in Richmond, you know, thank goodness there has been the benefit of the Richmond Symphony for many, many years, and it's not too far to get up to D.C. to go to the national performances. It's a lot easier once you get out of Texas to go to different places. So I think this audience has had more exposure, probably more knowledgeable, and I just hope that they don't take it for granted, because there's no reason why that Carpenter Theater shouldn't be completely sold out every time the symphony has a concert, because back in Texas, it was always packed. Because even though we didn't have it all the time and were probably a much less sophisticated audience, it was a big deal. So people went.
Do you think Richmonders take it for granted?
You know, it pains me to see that all kinds of other events, you know, entertainment events, can be sold out and you have traffic is backed up and everything. And I don't want to say that it's taken for granted, but it just falls down the list of priorities. And our civilization will be remembered for our artistic achievements. We know Egypt because of their pyramids and the art they created, not because of some other thing. So I hope that it's just been circumstances. People are busy and they can't go, because that would really be painful to think that people didn't appreciate all the music resources that they have, all the art resources that exist in Richmond, Virginia.
This raises an interesting sort of philosophical question. What is the importance of classical music? Why should people pay attention?
For me, it is the voice of, not just the voice of the composer, but the voice of humanity going as far back as we can remember. And while not everybody is qualified or able to play a musical instrument, everybody can hum a tune. And so we share that common voice. You know, you don't have to know that a certain piece of music was written as the composer was on his deathbed, or he wrote this for the love of his life and it was unrequited love. You don't have to know that. You can feel it. So I think it's a way of us staying connected to a past that very much still has relevance today, and that we're still going through all of those same complications, joys, and sorrows at the same time.
How much do you see your job as feeding that interest, encouraging that interest?
My whole philosophy with this station is, and I guess it started back at KMBH with that first classical station, I do not believe in being lofty and holding the music above your head. I want to share it with you like, this is a fantastic book, you've got to read it. Or, I just went to this amazing restaurant, you've got to try it out. That is the enthusiasm with which I hope I present the music, because that's how I feel about it. And it's, you know, a little kid doesn't know that, oh, I'm not supposed to be qualified to listen to that. And they love it. So I want everybody to feel that way.
What makes it strike a chord with you? I mean, you went through your teenage years. I'm sure you were enamored of rock and roll and whatever else was popular. What made the classical music, and I want to get into the definition of classical music in a minute here too, but what is it that attracted you personally?
It was always present. My parents, as I mentioned, certain cultural events would only happen once a year, but they'd always make sure we were there. Mm. We always went to the Nutcracker. We heard Peter and the Wolf a million times when I was a kid and was amazed every single time. There were always those, CDs, albums in the house. So it was probably something that they planted in me that just really took root. You know, because I have no other explanation as to why a little girl in deep South Texas who doesn't get to see it all the time, it just resonated. And yet I'm not a musician. I mean, I would say I play enough piano to get in trouble at a party. I'm like, sorry, that's all I know. But I always felt like there has to be an audience for those that can play. And I'm a very enthusiastic audience member, whether in the booth or actually sitting out at a concert.
We're talking with Bobby Barajas, who is the music director of WCVE Public Radio in Richmond. and the host of the classical music program from 11 in the morning till 3 in the afternoon, Monday through Friday. I mentioned before I want to get into the definition of classical music. Classical music is like all-encompassing, or not all, but it's a big field. And there's Baroque, and there's Romantic, and there's true classical, and so on and so on. Like, break it down for our audience. And do you have a favorite period?
Well, as you mentioned, there are the different defined eras, and they are very clearly defined by years, from pre-Baroque and Renaissance and Baroque, classical, Romantic, 20th century, and now I guess what we would call 20th century is now outdated, isn't it?
Right.
So I think we're still counting in Philip Glass as part of 20th century, although he still lives in this time.
Mm-hmm.
So it encompasses all of this, and I think the correct term is concert music, but we call it all classical. And do I have a favorite? You know, I kind of tend towards the Romantic composers, I think. Well, I say that. Beethoven, he is by far my favorite. I actually have had many dreams about him.
Really?
I had one dream where I was interviewing him, just like we're sitting here right now. And I was trying to figure out, what has he written? Because I can't, if he hasn't written the ninth, I better not talk about that. He might disappear, because I was very much aware that I shouldn't have this modern equipment and be talking to him, you know? Mm. Absolutely love him. Rachmaninoff, so close to my heart. I don't think I have any Russian DNA, but when I hear music by Rachmaninoff, it seems to spark something different in me. So, I don't know.
These are composers that strike a chord with you.
Yes.
Who is doing music today that 100 years from now will be considered concert music?
Wow. You know, that's a really good question. I feel that right now I'm focused a lot on the musicians, and they might turn out to be people who write music, but I can answer it in a different way.
Okay.
Maybe. I think that what we see happening with Gustavo Dudamel and Elsie Stemma, I think it might even be a kid right now that is studying, and now Elsie Stemma is all over the world. It's right here in Richmond and across Virginia. I think it could come from somewhere in there, but you need a big cheerleader like Dudamel, and certainly the work that he's doing with the LA Philharmonic. I think he's the next Bernstein who's going to make classical music more accessible, because he does not come across with this snobby appeal at all. So I think that person might be in there as a composer right now, but I think it's very much the artists that are making big waves right now.
Which brings up the point of education, music appreciation. I had music appreciation classes in high school and in college. They don't seem to be so prevalent anymore. And you're shaking your head that's a bad thing. I'm sure you would agree.
Yes.
What do we do?
It's of great concern to me that the arts are the first to take the cuts. That's
right.
And as I said earlier, we'll be remembered by the art that we create, you know, thousands mm-hmm. of years from now. That's how we'll be known. It is important that we invest that time. There are more organizations now. I don't even know what they call them. But it's like Elsie Stemma, where students can take lessons, not at school, and it's not like they're traditional music, you know, piano lessons, where they're becoming formed as young musical minds, either free or very, or on a sliding scale, or very inexpensive. And I'm so thankful that this is happening, because it might be the only way that it's going to happen. It's much more than learning scales, because I think the people that are coming to the forefront and working on this are actually, they're going to be responsible for that education. A kid that grew up in my same hometown, he's a few years younger, he's actually one of my brother's age, they went to school together. He's in Portsmouth, and he has just started an Elsie Stemma program. There's another one right here in Richmond, started by Linnell Ettinger, who's with the American Youth Harp Ensemble. And students who have no fiscal means are being given a proper music education. And it's a shame that funding for these important programs have been cut, but I can be nothing but a very enthusiastic person for these individuals that take it upon themselves. It's not easy. It still costs them money. But that's how important it is. So I have to be their champion.
And you do your part I've listened to your program, and you explain things. That's important to you. You don't just say, here's so-and-so, and it's by so-and-so. You explain a little bit about it.
I try to, and I don't worry about... I don't ever talk technically, because I think the professional musicians out there, the musicologists, they already know. But what a person might not know is that human story. Mm-hmm. I told a really good one yesterday about the Kennedys meeting Stravinsky.
I heard that.
And I thought, you know, Stravinsky's opinion of the Kennedys, they're nice kids. You know, I thought, that's great. That's great. So.
And then you played a nice short piece.
Yes.
That was an elegy.
To JFK. That's what it was called. Yeah.
And so you're combining the music, which you appreciate and you hope your audience will appreciate, with some background that will give them some context.
Exactly. I think if there's an understanding of where this falls in place, people can draw their own connections. And it's an exciting thing when you get two things that do connect.
Do you think that there's one public television station in Richmond, for all practical purposes, that plays consistently classical music at a specific time of day? Would you like to see competition?
I think competition is always good because it makes you step up a little bit more. You know, that it will happen. I mean, I guess it could. Mm-hmm. But I guess I am respectfully aware of it and would just like to see how we could have a competition that would make each organization climb a little higher.
A little synergy at work.
Yeah, yeah.
You bring in people on your program. Bring in musicians. You have the conductor of the Richmond Symphony on occasionally when you do your live symphony broadcasts. When you have them in the studio, do you have to bring them down and, like, we're talking to laymen here? Or does everybody feel the same need to educate that you do?
I think that we just try to talk in very easy terms. I don't have to tell Stephen Smith or Aaron Freeman with the Richmond Symphony, okay, don't talk technically, because I think they understand my philosophy, which is like, this is about sharing the art form. It's not about, you know, a doctorate level class in theory or something, you know. And so we talk about the people, because at the heart of it, that's what makes it interesting. It is what we can all relate to. It's the context. You said it earlier. It's putting whatever piece of music we're talking about or whatever composer, putting it into a context. And really, where things fit in history is also very telling.
Speaking of the guests that you have, one of the big boosts, I think, for the Richmond Symphony was when you began broadcasting them live. And you do an excellent job. I mean, the presentation of a city's symphony on either radio or television says a lot about a city. And you've done that. Has it had an effect? Have you noticed or been told of any effects that your broadcasts are having?
I should clarify that now that the Carpenter Theater Center Stage is open, we can't do those live anymore. Although we're looking to possibly find a way to go back and do it. But it was when the symphony was playing at the churches around town that we were able to do that. So we just did a delayed broadcast last week with the Richmond Symphony, and that was fantastic, and I think we were all energized. It was that, you know, it was like a little reunion. We were all back together again for the same purpose.
Was this live on tape?
Yes, yes. So it was performed at 3:30.
The same thing.
Yes, it was performed at 3:30 in the afternoon. We ran it that night at 8 o'clock after the governor's State of the States address. Mm-hmm. So it just, you know, it made for a nice program that way. The business and then the pleasure. This was also at the time when Mark Russell Smith was here. And I've got to tell you that I think people were like, does she work with the symphony? Or does he kind of work with the station? Because we did so much together. And not just, you know, Mark and myself, but the entire symphony. I really got to know these people. They're wonderful people who truly care about what they're doing and the audience that they serve. It was a great time for both, for both.
As a longtime broadcaster myself, I have to admire the technical aspects of it. Now, do you have an engineer that you like to work with for these?
Sam Strauss and I did a lot of work together. And we found Ed Kelly, who was the Richmond Symphony's engineer. So it took the two of them to kind of keep things going, because at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Glen Allen, there's no radio booth there. They have no need. So I'm sitting in an aisle, and we found out after that very first broadcast, Sam became more of the human wall, because as I'm on air trying to talk, people are trying to talk to me. I'm on air on the mic, but they, you know, they see the radio person there and they want to ask her a question. So it's interesting the things that you end up doing that you never think you're going to do in a broadcast.
So you owe a lot to your engineer.
Oh, yeah.
We're sitting in your office at 23 Sesame Street in Bon Air, and I look around and I see a big Texas flag.
Yeah.
And I don't see any posters of Bach or Beethoven or any of that.
I got Chopin, Schubert. I got
they're behind me.
They're behind you, yeah. Bernstein.
What do you listen to at home?
Actually, I do listen to a lot of classical music.
Do you really?
A certain frame of mind. The other thing I listen to is something that I very much grew up with, which at this point I guess is called classic country. But in Texas, you can't grow up in Texas and not be listening to this. And so those are kind of the two things. I don't know anything about contemporary country music at all. Yeah, I find that I listen to the pop music that I grew up with much, much less. So it's now, I guess, classical music and classic country.
But you know about the two-step and border music
All
of that.
Oh, yes. Yeah, that you... Once again, you can't grow up in South Texas and not know it.
Yeah, exactly. Is there a regional difference in Virginia? When you got here, did you notice a regional difference in interest other than classical music?
For myself, I actually really became attuned to bluegrass music.
Did you?
And that
Appalachian music.
Yes, which of course I knew what it was, but I actually have had an opportunity to hear it a lot more here. Mm-hmm. And my boss, Bill Miller, is a big fan of that kind of music, and he's kind of, you know, as I've expressed interest, he said, well, try listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
So I am absolutely fascinated by the history. You know, when my family would come up to visit, I'd say, okay, pick a war, revolutionary or civil, because we can't do it all in one day.
Right.
So, and I love where I live now, here in Richmond, because of all of the different cultural opportunities, the historical opportunities, just the beauty. I mean, to drive out to Charlottesville on a Sunday is just like the most beautiful thing ever.
It's a Chamber of Commerce commercial.
Right? Right, it is. So,
what's next for Bobby Barajas? Do you see yourself spending your career here?
Again, even though I'm not a spring chicken anymore, I still feel like I'm too young to say this is it.
What would you like to do? What would be your ideal job?
Gosh, I'm such a glutton for punishment. I would like to go to another area, like in the beginning in South Texas, that has never had public radio, and start a station there.
You are a glutton for punishment.
I am, because that's really hard work and there's no glory and you build from the ground up. But I know how much it meant to me. And I now know that kids just like me that are growing up there now, that they now have public radio and that they're not as deprived as I was. So, yeah.
Bobby, it's been a delight to get to know more about you and to have you as a guest on What's Your Story. Thank you very much. We've been talking with Bobby Barajas, who's the music director for WCVE Public Radio and the host of the Classical Music Program, weekdays, Monday through Friday. I'm Don Dale, and I hope you'll join us next time on the Virginia Voice for What's Your Story?
You've been listening to What's Your Story with Don Dale. If you know somebody with a story to tell, or if you'd like to tell your own story, telephone the Virginia Voice, 804-266-2477. And be sure to join us next time for What's Your Story? This is Charles Mink speaking, and this is the Virginia Voice.